Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Woo, Lord. TGIF, good morning. Brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. And, glad it's Friday. And glad you all have made some time to be with us this morning. We are going to do a little catch-up because we haven't had a chance to do that. And there's just so much to talk about. And we have with us this morning, back live, Mr. Kevin Anderson, Attorney Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hello, 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 hello. Good morning to you.
How's it going?
It's going okay. I'm very busy right now. So
yeah.
That explains my absence and waywardness. But I'm around. You know, I listen to the show when I can. I've been on the road quite a bit, and I tune in to stay informed. Thank you for never missing a beat, G.
Oh, trying. I do occasionally, and I just have to make it go as smooth or sound as smooth as possible. But always a pleasure to have you back, sir, and goodness gracious. I might just let you take the wheel on this because there's so much to talk about. So where would you like to begin?
Well, the wheel has gone full circle. A lot has been happening, both on the international stage and the local stage. But I'm going to hang out on the local stage. Let's start talking about some things that are coming up. First of all, tomorrow marks the 10th anniversary since the Trayvon Martin case evolved. His shooting was February 26th. 10 years ago, and a lot of people probably will be reminded of that, but just don't remember it right now because a lot of time has passed.
It doesn't seem like it's been that long.
It doesn't seem as if it's been that long, but, you know, I was listening to a radio broadcast about 3 weeks ago, and one of the speakers made that statement, and I looked it up, and wow, been 10 years. It's been 10 years. Which is kind of interesting. And Zimmerman actually sued Trayvon Martin's parents for defamation. His lawsuit was dismissed. I believe it was this week, actually, or maybe late last week, thankfully. But you know, that just takes, you know, a lot of nerve to sue them and based on statements that he just didn't want to be made, but they were not untrue. So that kind of flew under the radar because there are so many things happening in the national media until, you know, something like Zimmerman objecting to a defamation lawsuit could easily go unnoticed. So moving right along, let's see. Let's talk about the woman who you affectionately call Taser Girl. All right. As some of the listeners may recall, we're talking about Kimberly Potter. She was convicted for killing Dante Wright. And she claimed that the shooting of Mr. Wright was accidental because she attempted to draw her taser, but recklessly grabbed the firearm, both of which were around her waist, and she discharged a single shot, killing Dante Wright. Ultimately, mm-hmm. she went to trial, and she was found guilty for manslaughter in the first and the second degree. And her sentencing for those two charges took place earlier in the month. She was sentenced to 24 months in the Minnesota Department of Corrections. She had been in custody for a grand total of 58 days. So, of course, she was accorded the credit for that time that she spent in custody. But both charges carried significant jail time. The first-degree manslaughter charge carried 15 years as a maximum penalty, and the second-degree manslaughter charge carried 10 years as a maximum penalty. However, under Minnesota law, only the highest crime is something that a person convicted for those offenses together could the judge sentence that individual to under the circumstances. So both parties, the state and the defense, argued for what's known as an upward departure based upon aggravating circumstances or a downward departure based upon mitigating circumstances. The departure is a variance from what's known as a sentencing guideline presumptive range of a sentence that could be given to Ms. Potter. Well, the judge found that there were mitigating circumstances and departed downwardly to arrive at that 24-month sentence. The basis was that the act by Kimberly Potter was unintentional and that Kimberly Potter had shown remorse for the death of Mr. Wright. And the sentencing, if you watched it, was tear-jerking, certainly something that, I think affected everyone, whether you agreed or disagreed with the judge's sentence. But ultimately, you haven't heard a lot about that event since it happened. Just a little here and there, but not a lot, not a whole bunch. So just kind of, wondering, and I'm keeping my ear to the pavement to, particularly to see what some of these civil rights practitioners have to say about that, that sentence, our Black community, in what is a read on the judge's calculus or some of the disparity arguments that could be made with respect to, what may have happened to, let's say, for example, a person of color who had done that to someone who was not Black or brown. And, we'll see. I don't think that chapter's closed, and I think there will be a comment and some critique in the near future, about what took place.
I guess the thing that gets me is, and none of us are flawless, however, this is a person that was in the process, while this happened, of training someone. This person is supposed to have a better handle on her tools of the trade, I would expect, And so that's kind of why the whole thing, and then part of it just seemed kind of fake, the whole taser thing. I'm not sure about her sincerity, but, who am I to, I'm not in the judge's seat, but, we'll just have to wait and see what comes down the road. And there's just so much right now. So, but we'll keep an eye on that.
I think you're not hearing a lot because mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people who accept her apology. They accept the fact that people do commit error, even though they've done something repeatedly for year after year after year. And the event did come on the heels of such an onerous murder by Derek Chauvin.
Right.
And you know, when you compare and contrast the two, these are exponentially polarized. So I looked at what took place and I listened to the sentencing hearing. And I'm not going to be critical of what the judge judged in that particular case. On its face, it passes muster. My heart goes out to the right does.
Yeah.
This was a tragic, unfortunate event. And I'm not trying to minimize what Kimberly Potter did. Please, don't anyone think that I'm doing so. I'm just not going to be as critical of what happened as some might be.
Okay.
All right.
So, well, you're the expert. I somewhat try to follow your lead on these things. In the meantime, I wanted to ask you if you got a chance to look at, I've got to find it because I sent it on my phone. Now I've got to find it where I can post it about the article about civil rights, the one with Clarence Thomas. Did you get a chance to look at that?
I am
I know
aware.
You've been busy.
Excuse me. I am aware of what you're talking about. I think this is the case involving the expression, whether the case that's before the Supreme Court regarding LGBTQ citizens is now going to essentially give the Supreme Court an opportunity to dismantle civil rights laws as we now know them. Is that the one you're talking about?
I think so. And I have a, I don't know. I have a question with regards to, you know, and no disrespect meant, but lumping LGBTQ issues in with race issues. I just think they're different, but they seem to try to use the same measuring stick for both of them. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the what they're doing is they're determining whether discrimination can be allowed based on certain constitutional protections that we would otherwise be afforded.
Right.
And, when you're talking about race, when you're talking about, gender or national origin or religion or expression, everything is coupled into pretty much the same basket. The issue in this particular case that's going before the Supreme Court is one that pertains to expression, and it just happens to relate to a LGBTQ event, but it does not have to.
Okay.
And, back in I think it was 2017, there was a case, and for those who follow, some of the cases that are out there, the name of it was Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado
Yes.
Civil Rights Commission, and that case dealt with a baker's refusal to provide a wedding cake to a same-sex couple, and the case never did answer the question, and the question was whether what the baker refused to do was in fact a constitutional issue, and it revolved around expression, which is protected.
Mm-hmm.
Whether baking a cake, or not baking a cake, dealt with constitutionally protected rights particularly the right of expression. And
right.
It just kind of, that case just kind of fizzled and kind of left everyone dangling. Now, today we have before the court another case, which, again, for our case followers, that case is called 303 Creative versus Elenis, and that's E-L-E-N-I-S. And this one involves a person who is an artist. The person, in fact, is a graphic designer who is going to be making creative websites. And this graphic designer is going to refuse to do those websites for same-sex couples. Now, in this particular case, the issue of expression is a lot clearer because it centers on actual speech, i.e. the creation of a website, which is undoubtedly a form of expression. So in that particular case, you are going to listen to the parties argue about whether the speech or the expression that is the issue is one in which we can now deal with the underlying issue of discrimination based on the speaker or the actor's decision to render services to an individual based on some protected right. So, you know, again, you know, it just happens to relate to the LGBT community, you know, but it doesn't have to. They could relate to somebody or someone else.
Okay, so I have to express this concern, and that is that in the effort to protect a lot of these other rights, what is happening with our freedom of religion? Right. I mean, it just seems that it's getting chipped away at all sides, and I'm having an issue with that. So,
well, I think it happens to relate to LGBTQ, just like it could relate to someone who is, you know, coming to like a baker or going to a graphic designer and asking them, you know, to do something which clearly reflects their religious choices or whatever faith that you know, they observe.
Right.
You know, we're not actually making a judgment call about a quality of life decision or about who we're going to worship. What we're doing is we are dealing with the underlying constitutional right that goes along with that individual who is, you know, bringing to you a service which relates to something that you might object to or something that you may want to might want to promote. It's a little complex. It's not cut and dry.
No, it's not. It's especially when you bring religion into play, when you talk about someone's faith, and someone who truly lives their faith believes that, you know, my getting, you know, to heaven or my ultimate goal in life or my let's say, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, if you want to talk about, you know, U.S. Constitution or whatever, has to do with my ability to be able to live my faith without harassment or being, you know, sued or whatever the case may be. So, I mean, I just don't necessarily hear the strong arguments or defense of that as I hear with the others.
Religion's tough, too, because you're talking about two constitutional rights there. Religion in and of itself is something that we are afforded the right to practice and is recognized as a constitutional freedom. And also expression would be one of those rights. So you would have a double whammy with respect to religion. And I would venture to say that religion would be embraced a lot more firmly, and the arguments would sound a lot louder and a lot clearer if any issue pertained to religion. Now, I think the fault is perhaps that those people who practice that faith just aren't making the arguments, and they're not bringing the lawsuits. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I have said regularly on here, you know, where are our religious leaders, our church leaders, our leaders in the faith? You know, I mean, it's gotten to the point, I think, it's just, you know, there's fear or there's reluctance because maybe some of them are not, let's say, living in glass houses, don't want stones thrown, type of thing. I don't know.
Interesting. Hypocrites, is that a better characterization?
Yeah, I didn't want to use that word. Maybe, possibly, yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah. Hmm. But anyway.
Hmm. Yeah. Maybe they're not competent enough to challenge this issue, because it does involve more than just, you know, preaching on Sunday morning. You know, it involves
right.
a studious and cogent argument that is grounded on constitutional principles. And mm-hmm. if you want to weave in your faith, then that's great. But, like, when you show up, man, in a courtroom, your faith is not going to carry the day if you can't make the legal argument.
Right. But, I mean, isn't this a case where you're like, you recognize and acknowledge, okay, I know faith and religion, but I don't know law. But maybe I can get align myself with someone who does know the law and how to defend it. You know, my freedom of religion rights. You know, and that, because there are people out there, I'm sure that's where their strengths are in terms of that type of defense. Right?
Correct. Yes, you are absolutely correct. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, I'm a podcaster. Don't go and expect me to be a lawyer. You know?
Absolutely.
I probably would be behind bars probably or something, you know, trying to defend myself.
So
that's why you align yourself. You get people that know how to practice law when it comes to those types of things, and you don't try to go out there and do it. You know?
I agree.
Yeah.
So okay.
Who else are we talking about? Well, I know we've got to go to Georgia, right?
We are going to Georgia. You want to go to Georgia now, or you want to go to Georgia later? You tell me.
Hey, we can go to Georgia anytime you want.
Okay, we're headed there. All right.
Okay.
So, all right. You're talking about the three men who killed Ahmaud Arbery.
Yes.
Obviously, it's not so obvious. I'll just say that these three men were found guilty for killing Ahmaud Arbery in state court. They were sentenced to life. There has been concurrent jurisdiction exercised at the federal level. This time, the three men were charged with civil rights violations, attempted kidnapping, and firearms charges. Oftentimes what happens is that when a state court exercises jurisdiction, a federal court may exercise, or in other words, the same jurisdiction that would afford them the ability to prosecute these individuals, but timing is an issue. In this case, the mm-hmm. federal court waited until the state court finished. Now, the McMichaels, both Travis and Greg McMichael, and also William Roddy Bryant, they were convicted.
Because I forget his name all the time.
Not a problem. They were convicted for targeting Ahmaud Arbery as a black man for purposes of a hate crime violation. That was the highest offense that those men could have been charged for and convicted of. That carries a life penalty and, in some instances, death. I didn't stutter. However, in this case, the United States Sentencing Guidelines is the rubric that I believe these men are going to be sentenced under, and they will get a substantially less sentence than, you know, obviously death. I don't think they're going to be killed. You know, even though, you know, that is a possibility, I don't think it's a probability. In addition, the three men were convicted of attempted kidnapping, as I said, and two of them, the McMichaels, were charged with the firearms violations and convicted for those two offenses. Their sentencing is forthcoming. We know they got life. Again, you know, I repeat that in the state case. So at this point, they could get life again. But I just don't think those guys will ever be released from custody ever again. That is what happened to those men in a nutshell. All right, sentencing's forthcoming, and of course, you know, we'll be tuned in for that.
So I guess what I want to know, you know, there's a part of me, of course, is like, yeah, whatever you can do, any which way you can do it, that's fine. But in just for practicality purposes, what is the reason if they're already going to probably be behind bars for life on a state level, what is the reason for bringing about the federal charges? What does that accomplish?
Well, it addressed the hate crime, the federal civil rights hate crime. And the precedent and the precedence and the importance of holding those men accountable for what they did based solely on the decedent's race is important for the community, the national community, in order to send that signal. And that we're just not doing that anymore. We're not chasing people down like an animal and killing them because they're black or because they don't look like you. You know, and I think to embrace that as a black man, to know that our Justice Department thought enough of what happened to just say, wait a minute, now I'm going to get my piece too. I'm going to pursue this on behalf of the United States of America, because we aren't playing that song anymore. It's huge. You know, I know I walked away feeling like, okay, there you go, man. I like that. You know, so we do have the government going to bat for us. Second, what would happen if the Georgia appellate courts elected to reverse the sentences that either defendant was adjudged? And let's say they got a new trial, and you know, before the trial commenced, they took a plea bargain that would have afforded them the ability to get out of prison one day. Now they don't have a backdrop. So the federal case served as a safety net to ensure that these men were given their just due. I think that probably answers that question for you.
Okay. Yeah, that works. Yeah, so, and never mind. I could go off on so many tangents on this one, but now. That's good, I guess, for future cases and whatnot. Do you think enough with regards to the murder of Mr. Arbery? Do you think enough has been done to the satisfaction of his family that's left to mourn and grieve him?
I really don't know what else other than prosecuting the prosecutor can be done. They could have been, I guess, put to death. I guess you're asking me whether I wanted them to be put to death. It sounds like, I mean, because everything else that I can imagine has been done.
All right. Now, I just was wondering, was there more to be done? Should there be more? And you know, I mean, because, you know, obviously nothing's going to bring back Mr. Arbery and you know, the the family is without their loved one. But I was just curious in terms of what other recourses there might be available. And, you know, because now that everything, unfortunately, everything's been done, you know, it kind of just, you know, I guess my thing is, what happens next? What happens to keep this, I guess, relevant, or, you know, the situation on the forefront so that people don't forget, and so that people who may consider doing this won't forget what the possibility is of, you know, in terms of punishment for that behavior. You know, my fear is just, you know, it fading back into the background somewhere, you know.
Yeah, general deterrence is always a sentencing consideration, mm-hmm. and specific deterrence as well. We know that the mm-hmm. men are specifically deterred because they're never going to get out. At least it looks that way. Mm-hmm. And as far as the public's concerned, with respect to the goals of general deterrence, there are people who would refrain from this type of conduct because of what was observed. And I think there are people who understand the wrongfulness of what happened and will at least – even if they don't agree, they will understand that what happened is unacceptable. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. you know, sin has been with us ever since the creation of the world.
Yep.
And if people won't refrain from doing, you know, sinful acts to save themselves, what makes you think that a conviction of one or two folks is going to change their minds? You know, I think that's going to be here.
That's true. But I guess what it is, too, is a matter of perspective, and about the sin and stuff like that. That's a whole different show I could talk on that and have some other people out there. But I guess what I'm thinking is that perspective in terms of, you know, you probably have some people that are still saying, well, I don't think they should have gotten punished. They really didn't do anything wrong. You know, I mean, nothing. There's some people that this is not going to change them.
No, and it's never going to change some people. I mean, just, and if you're woke, okay, let's just put it out there. You know, go back and look at Charlottesville. All right, look at Charlottesville. Who would have thought that what happened in Charlottesville would have happened? You know, you're looking at that going like, whoa, where did these guys come from? I thought they were done. No, man. Look at January 6th. Where did these guys come from? What's going on? There are people who will never change. They will never change. I don't care how logical and how convincing you think you are. It's just never going to happen. You're not going to change their minds. You know?
Yeah. I'm going to do something different. I'm catching you off guard. I know you're going to hate me. I'm going to actually ask you to do your own commercial.
Do my own commercial?
Do your own commercial.
Okay. All right. When would you like
Put
me to do
there.
My own commercial? All right.
Yeah.
So the law offices of Anderson and Welch, we focus on civil rights representation, particularly police liability, which addresses false arrest, excessive force, malicious prosecution, and those things which relate to wrongs done against people by use of the criminal justice process. For example, if a person is accused of a crime and they really didn't commit the crime and they are then exonerated, we give that individual the hope of somehow recouping their expenses, their dignity, and addressing the wrongful arrest and the prosecution that may have been maliciously brought against them in a court of law. In addition, we also represent individuals for criminal defense litigation purposes. My practice is actively engaged in that representation in both the federal and state courts throughout Florida and the nation. So at any given point, you'll find me either in Georgia, you'll find me in Florida, you may even find me in California, depending on what's taking place. We are welcome. We welcome you to call us. We hope none of those things happen to you, but if it should happen, remember, Anderson and Welch will be here to at least answer your questions, and never know, we may form an attorney-client relationship.
See, I think you did that so much better than what we've been playing. Should have recorded that. Well, it is recorded, so we might have to take a clip and redo that. So anyway, thank you. And we will be posting a link to Anderson Welch on the G-Power Hour Facebook page. But in the meantime, do you want to talk about the most recent nomination for Supreme Court Justice?
I caught that this morning. Now, I don't think that that's official yet, right? That's just kind of the scuttle, even though it's good scuttle and probably very, like, reliable scuttle. I'll just say that. Because I'm hearing it, you know, on MSNBC. I'm hearing it on CNN. Some of my colleagues, some Fox and friends have, like, kind of, like, blurted out, you know, and I'm thinking, all right, so you guys are saying it. It must be right, you know. So,
yeah.
Yes, I know all about her. Ketanji Brown Jackson, if she is, in fact, nominated, she is presently a justice on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is perhaps the most important circuit with respect to federal affairs when there are lawsuits that arise from legislation coming out of the U.S. Congress or the executive branch administrative orders that need to be dealt with. Those lawsuits typically occur in the D.C. Circuit. Those justices generally are some of the sharpest justices that are on the bench. With respect to Ms. Or Justice Judge Jackson, if she is nominated, she will be the third black justice and the sixth woman in the history of the United States Supreme Court to be elevated to that position. Surprisingly, Judge Jackson was actually born in Florida, right in Miami. She grew up in Miami-Dade County, and she went to high school in Miami-Dade County. And I'll give them a shout-out. The school was Miami Palmetto Senior High School. I don't think many people know that. I'm giving it to you.
Thank you.
Judge Jackson went on to attend Harvard College, which is the undergrad, and then Harvard Law School. Mm-hmm. These are some of the most prestigious institutions in the country with respect to a number of disciplines. She, at the law school, distinguished herself by becoming one of the editors for the Harvard Law Review, which is an acclaimed critical publication that allows lawyers from all over the country to submit articles that are peer-reviewed and are critiqued and are often cited in arguments and utilized in the practice of law for a number of concentrations. Passed the bar and began to clerk for Justice Breyer from the United States Supreme Court, the same justice that she's going to replace. I got to tell you, you know, this woman could have written her ticket anywhere, but she chose to serve the public as a federal public defender, and they don't make a lot of money. They don't get a lot of glory. They get cases that people run from, but it is honorable service, and the federal public defenders are some of the most valiant practitioners known to man. I take my hat off to them. They are the counterpart to assistant U.S. attorneys. There's no federal public defender that I don't respect. I'll tell you that, and I see them all the time. Following her stint as a federal public defender, she went on to be the vice chair of the United States Sentencing Commission. And that is the body of people who will determine and have determined the guideline range for the McMichaels and Roddy Bryant when they return for their sentencing. And that commission was designed to establish a set of sound principles so that everyone would be considered the same and sentenced relatively the same without consideration for things like race and gender and parts of the country where people may do one thing and then another part of the country where that same thing may or may not be acceptable. So it brought parity to the sentencing process. She's married. She has two daughters. And her husband, which is something, again, that I'm sure people don't really know, is related somehow to the former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. I believe like really close, like almost like a brother like that. So I think she'll be a fine justice, and I look forward to that confirmation process. She should sail right through, provided
really?
That we don't have – well, I'll say, you know.
I was going to ask you about that.
Just last year, she had been vetted by the Senate, and she was confirmed. Okay, and I believe the vote was like not just an onion skin affirmation. This was a vote that was supported by Lindsey Graham, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski. And we know that these are GOP senators from South Carolina, Maine, and mm-hmm. Alaska, respectively. So I can't imagine like a year later that, you know, those three senators will now object to the very person who they gave the nod to a year earlier. But you know what? You know, I won't be surprised. I'll say if it happens, but I don't think that they would have a cogent argument to support that objection. So, mm-hmm. But that's what I know about Judge Jackson. And let's see what happens. I'll keep my ear tuned.
How did I know that you would be in the know and to school us on this? So I'm glad I asked. Well, I mean, now given the other potential nominees that were named, did you feel that this was the person, I mean, before it was announced, did you feel that this was the person that should have been the pick out of the people he was vetting, that President Biden was vetting?
They were all qualified. There is no one who could be to these judges who had better credentials. There may be someone who had credentials that were just as good, but these mm-hmm. women represent the cream of the crop, the top jurist in the country. And I thought for a moment that the jurist from South Carolina, I thought she's a federal judge there, and because there were connections to Lindsey Graham, and what's his name? The senator out of
come on, Princess, help us out here. Are you there? She would know.
He actually helped Biden, President Biden, when it came to his nomination to Jim Clyburn.
Okay,
correct. Jim Clyburn. Okay, so Senator Clyburn and Graham, Senator Graham, you know, and Clyburn isn't a senator, by the way. Clyburn is from the U.S. House of Representatives. Tim Scott's that other senator in South Carolina. But Graham and Clyburn, they pushed and pushed and pushed. They want this South Carolinian to be the next nominee. So I kind of thought that Biden might bow make that concession, but he didn't. But I would have been happy with any of the women who were being considered for this nomination, because, again, they were all ultra qualified.
Okay. All right. Like I said, though, I am glad I asked you because you gave me probably a lot more information than I would have found out through our mainstream media. So that's good. So I also wanted to ask you, let me find his name. I know the first name. It's Amir. Wanted to ask you about the case where the gentleman was shot. He had a gun. Amir Jackson, I believe that's his name. That the police shot. They were looking for someone else. They came in. He was asleep. I think they said it was it 7 seconds or something. Between the time that they came in the door and a guest announced themselves and the time that he was shot dead. So,
go ahead.
And I'll find the name. Amir what?
Amir Locke.
Thank you.
Yeah, Amir Locke. Yeah, that's unfortunate, man. That's sad. And you would ask whether, whether what happens in our courts will change things in the future and, how it impacts what takes place. I mean, look at this. Look, it's a mess. When I saw that, here we go, and we're talking Minneapolis, the same place.
Let me ask you this, because this is the thing that got me, and maybe it's because I don't necessarily live in the same environment as someone who would have a gun while they're sleeping. Okay, I don't think I could, I know I don't want to, but I don't think I could live in an environment like that. I think I'd have to move or go somewhere else. But I mean, seriously, is that? I guess I want to say that right. That is also another debate when it comes to rights of being able to defend yourself and your life and your property by having a weapon. Is that going to be part of what goes on here? This debate between what the police did and what he did, and the result.
I don't think he did anything, though. I think, he did what everybody does, at a certain point, in the evening. We lay down and close our eyes and go to sleep. And, fact that when they came, that's what they say, okay? Like, that's why we have, jurors to be the finders of fact. There may have been a gun nearby. But, when I hear you ask me, whether he was sleeping, with a gun, I mean, it's not like he had it, under his pillow. Maybe he did, but that hasn't been proven. But I tell
right.
you what, I mean, if I'm sleeping in my house and someone, kicks my door in and it's night and it's dark and they come running up the stairs, why wouldn't I be justified in grabbing my firearm? What am I
right.
supposed to do? That's the number one tenet, protect your home, your castle, the castle
right.
doctrine affords you the right to protect your home. So, I don't fault what he did. They should not
okay.
have come in to his home like that. And I think that they need to pay for that. I don't agree with what happened. I just don't. I think that's reckless. I think these no-knock principles that are motivating these officers to enter, homes, need to be either stricken or closely scrutinized before that takes place. And I'll tell you, the trial of Brett Hankerson, guy who shot in Breonna Taylor's home, okay? Let's
oh,
not
yeah.
overlook that, is
mm-hmm.
taking place as we speak.
Right.
And that is something that is, under the radar. People, aren't even talking about it. And it's not even on the news, really. I mean, that's a big case where this lady, Breonna Taylor,
You know, she was shot and killed. And now, we thought that the police entered the house because of a no-knock warrant, but really, it wasn't a no-knock warrant because at the last minute, the no-knock warrant turned into a knock-and-announce warrant. But this officer, Brett Hankerson, you know, he is on the outside of the residence, and he fired into her window, and, you know, his shots, although they didn't hit her, they went through the wall into another residence, and it's that conduct that he is on trial for. Brett Hankerson, he was fired from the police department in Louisville, Kentucky, and charged with wanton endangerment. Three counts of it for the three bullets that went into the neighbor's house and didn't hit the neighbor. But Breonna Taylor, she gets hit by another officer's bullets and killed, and nothing happens. Yeah, problems. I got problems with that. You know, so.
Yeah, and supposedly jurors are expected, according to what I saw, or did go to visit the apartment to see where this all happened. Does it make a difference when the jurors go to a location to lay eyes on the site of the crime scene? Does it really make a difference?
Absolutely. It makes a big difference because the parties try to skew the evidence in a light most favorable to their theories. And so sometimes we leave out things, sometimes we exaggerate things, but when a juror has the benefit of your opening statements, which, you know, are not evidence, they're just roadmaps, and a witness or two, which kind of like lays a foundation before you get there, they now can weigh what you said or didn't say with what they see and their common sense. And, you know, when you're standing there and you're trying to get a feel for, like, well, what was the distance from the door to Ms. Taylor's bedroom? You know, and why was there a need to shoot inside of her house from outside the house? What did you see? What could you have seen?
Mm-hmm.
How dark was it, you know?
Right.
You know, was it chaos, you know, in this little teeny hallway which preceded, like, you guys, like, getting into the doorway? Like that kind of stuff. And, you know, apparently they also had pictures in this trial, which kind of, you know, were taken from afar, some were like, you know, enhanced.
Right.
An in-person view lets you see with your own eyes certain aspects of the case.
Right. That's just like looking at a picture before and after it was cropped. Well, not just like it, but similar to that. But, I mean, still, it's still also not – the picture is not going to do it justice versus getting a three-dimensional perspective of what happened. So,
Amen.
Yeah.
If you ever need me one
day,
okay,
you can look at a place and say, if I was living here, what would I have done? Where would I have gone? How would I have – you know, emerged from my bedroom or wherever I was in the house, you know, and you know, I was just curious, but yeah, now that I think about it, is if I was a juror, I would be asking probably a lot more questions than the questions I would ask based on two-dimensional evidence, you know.
Wow. Before we hang our boots up, let's not leave out the convictions of the three men, the three ex-officers in the George Floyd matter, which also proceeded to a federal civil rights trial. Excuse me. These men were accused of violating Mr. Floyd's civil rights by deprivation of his medical needs and failing to intervene when they saw Derek Chauvin assaulting and ultimately killing Mr. Floyd. The officers were a guy by the name of Officer Teo.
an officer Kung, and it's K-U-E-N-G, and an officer Lang. Only officer Lang escaped the failure to intervene because he did try to stop what took place. And on two occasions, apparently, Officer Lang, he asked the Derek Chauvin to ease up and, you know, hey, don't you think that's enough? Right? Hey, we're hurting him, that kind of thing. So he was not convicted for that particular count. But he was convicted for deprivation of Mr. Floyd's medical needs. These guys can face up to life and death. They're going to get life or death. But this is the same charge, essentially, that the gentleman, the McMichaels and Mr. Bryant, were facing in their federal trials. So that happened. I didn't want to get away from here without addressing that particular event.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. Like I said, there's so much out there to cover, but you've done a masterful job in terms of you know, breaking some stuff down for us and getting us updated. So what should we have our eyes on in the near future? Is there a particular case? Let me quickly, the no-knock warrants, what do you perceive is going to happen with that? Are there going to be changes? Are there going to be exceptions made? Or is it going to be retooled? Is it necessary?
There is a necessity for these surprise warrants on occasion. Certain entities that will be with us until the end of time will not allow you to take them into custody. And will certainly fight you if you try to catch them doing something that they shouldn't be doing. So I think there are occasions where the element of surprise is necessary. So my answer is yes. I think that we need to keep them. However, they have to be placed into perspective, and I think there has to be oversight, and we have to limit our usage of those warrants for circumstances that truly require those types of warrants. This cannot be a routine. This has to be on a case-by-case basis, and there must be a number of levels to review the necessity of this activity and the usage of this warrant as a last resort. You asked me where I thought we need to keep our eyes. It's on that particular issue. And I believe that's going to be a state-by-state issue. I just don't have any confidence in the federal legislative process at this point. To pass something that's going to be applicable in the near future, especially when in the interim we have people being subjected to that activity and dying, such as Amir Locke. So our state legislatures are going to have to refine these no-knock warrants, and we leave it up to our respective representatives to take those initiatives.
Attorney Kevin Anderson, you have been a godsend. Thank you for, like I said, masterfully handling all of this stuff. I didn't think we were going to get to everything to be able to at least touch on it, but we did. We touched on a lot of stuff, and I appreciate you taking the time. So get back to your busy life, but try to have a good weekend. Enjoy your weekend. Take some time out, you know, and have an actual weekend, okay?
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful weekend, and hopefully, God willing, I will talk with you on. This has been G's Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. Be well, be safe, be blessed, and please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.
Give up the high praise. 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 Get up on your feet in here.